Hello, I'm Adrian Daub.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
And whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So, Adrian, before we get started today, I know you had something you wanted to tell our listeners about.
Yes, and this will come as a shocker to people who've been listening to previous episodes. I have a book coming out, and I'd like you to pre-order it. I'm told by the powers that be to repeat that as often as possible. If you do still want to pre-order it, I had swag made. The swag is allegedly in the mail. It looks very pretty in pictures. It hasn't arrived yet. So if you pre-order and send me a proof of pre-order to cancel.research@gmail.com, I will send you said swag.
What's your book called, Adrian?
The book is called The Cancel Culture Panic, How an American Obsession Went Global. And it's about a lot of people we're going to be talking about today, the kind of international circuits of right-wing outrage machines and how these kinds of freakouts get internationalized, right? Like to the point that someone can say something kind of ill-considered at Harvard and suddenly like, you know, Spanish newspapers or Chilean or Argentinian newspapers will devote lots of column inches to it. And that's to some extent what we're talking about today as well, where, you know, people really got way into some stuff happening
that wasn't happening.
Right. They got too invested in things that weren't happening in the Ile-de-France.
So today we are talking about the swirl of gender controversies surrounding the 2024 Paris Olympics.
Yeah. And I should say that this is partly based on a Substack post I wrote. Yes, I have a Substack. Like every white guy in his 40s, I have a Substack. So free to subscribe to that too. Sorry, I'm just plugging shit here.
I mean, you should also rate and review us on iTunes while you're at
it.
I'll come clean and say that I, as a fan of Adrian Daub, I subscribe to his Substack. And I read his newsletter stemming from this most recent gender controversy at the Olympics. And I thought it was the smartest thing I had read, unsurprisingly, not just on this particular, you know, faux cancel culture controversy, but also on like the gender politics of the Olympic Games in particular, which are so fraught and so loaded and so weird.
when you
think about them, it's one of the most like esoteric, creepy, heavy-handed examples of gender binarism and gender essentialism that we sort of all just accept as a wholesome treat.
Yeah.
And I say this with no disrespect to the people actually competing at the Olympics who have nothing to do with any of this.
Very impressive. Very impressive.
You know, there's the incredibly like fit young people performing feats of strength. And then there are the rest of us like sweaty, pale dweebs on couches assessing them.
How do you miss that? Says I, as I wipe, you know, chips crumbs off my
My face is just t-shirt. Covered in chocolate, and I'm like, you got to run faster.
Yeah, what the hell, man?
So, do you want to talk about like our most recent moral panic du jour, and then we can expand a little more out into like what the Olympics accomplish for the gender regime?
Yeah. So, for those who have been spared all of this, things did not start well in terms of gender. I mean, they started well in an interesting way. They like Paris decided to do a kind of a different opening ceremony, which I have to say, given the frankly fascist aesthetic of recent Olympic Games, I was all for. I was like, ooh, this is just going to be a little goofy. And people did not take well to it. It was a little goofy. It was, I would say, a masterful performance, but not a masterpiece in editing. Like, there was the ultimate yes and performance. Like, it just felt like, and also Marie Antoinette will show up without her head. And you're like, okay. And then like, the Minions will be there because like, apparently that's animated.
The Minions are canonically French.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. The I don't know about their master, the evil guy, but the little yellow guys are all French.
Gru, I believe it's called.
That's a French name too. There you go.
Yeah.
Everybody's French in that movie. Yeah, it was corny and over the top in a way that I have come to expect from the French. I think like Americans tend to think of the French as really classy and fancy. And if you spend time there, you actually come to realize that they're a profoundly corny people.
it was a kind of corny maximalism. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And yet it was nothing if not charming, precisely because it was ebullient and it felt like they had left nothing, had held nothing back. But for all that, people got offended by it based on, you know, shitty art history. one of the conceits was that the paintings of the Louvre were coming alive. And they were sort of illusions in the background of a lot of the different stations that the opening ceremony sort of passed on its way down the Seine, where basically you would see famous paintings, sort of like motifs being picked up, right? There were two portraits that were sort of half submerged in the water. Some of it was computer animated. It was neat. And then there was one, I think they'd set it up on one of the bridges, which was a bunch of drag queens performing a painting called the Feast of Bacchus.
You know, likely place for drag queens to be, I gotta say, at the Feast of Bacchus. That's where I expect to find them.
Yeah, maybe we should do our Stefan voice. This place has everything. Gods, monsters.
Grapes.
And the human outrage machine. Now, Stefan, what is a human outrage? It's that thing where Elon Musk tweets about how disrespectful it is to Christians. Yeah, and so like the dumbest people you know.
About the Marie Antoinette, you know, famous Christian saint Marie Antoinette with her head off.
That was the weirdest part. I think he did it on a bunch of things.
Okay.
But it's true. The one that I found was like, he was like, oh, this is disrespectful to Christians about Marie Antoinette.
About Marie Antoinette with her head cut off. Yeah, I mean, I don't really think that she's revered by the Christians.
Patron saint of cake.
Yeah, I don't think Elon Musk knows who she is.
Yeah.
Or he might have taken some pointers from her story.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe he's just like, oh, she's a rich lady. And obviously they're godly.
I will say, like, about this controversy, the Feast of Bacchus performance in which these drag queens sort of posed in this arrangement that was supposed to evoke a painting about classical mythology, right? It was mistaken by people who've seen maybe one painting for clearly the only other time there's ever been a feast of anything. It was mistaken for, I believe, Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper.
Yeah.
Many world leaders are now denouncing this as a blatant insult to Christianity. It was this moment from the ceremony that invoked the sacred Christian image of the Last Supper, but it featured drag queens and dancers standing in the place of Jesus and his apostles.
And that was understood to be some sort of abomination. Anecdotally, I can say that like the priest at the church that I went to the next Sunday immediately started his homily. It was like it was beautiful readings about, you know, unrelated things. And then this priest gets up and he's like, you know what pissed me off? It was the Olympics. And I was just like, I'm out of here. But like they're very online. The online right was very, very mad about this. And it trickled down at least to my Nigerian priest in San Francisco.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, right? Like, this is actually something where I really benefited from your analysis of the trad wife, because I was like, these people are trad in exactly the way the trad wife is. Like, they feel disrespected. Really, they were uncomfortable with drag queens, if we're honest, right? They feel that something's being disrespected, but they want to call that tradition. But they don't know jack shit about that tradition, right?
Yeah.
Now, I haven't done the art historical research yet, but like my guess is that the Feast of Bacchus, of course, was supposed to evoke, like the painting is supposed to evoke, Last Supper paintings, right? So if there's sacrilege contained, it occurred in the 17th century.
It occurred a while ago, yeah.
Because it turns out, we have a long tradition of playing with religious imagery in Western art, you know, and sometimes that can skirt the line to disrespectful, I would say, and that those are some of the best paintings. And but it's like for them, this was like the first time they had like gadzooks.
The history of Christianity is all about appropriating other traditions and mimicking them or undoing them.
Yeah.
In various guises, like from Judaism itself through the you know, European paganism. They did this everywhere.
Yeah, like give us back Mithra's birthday, guys, if you're so into...
I want Saturnalia again, you know?
I know. again, Stefan voice, this Saturnalia has everything. I don't know, did you ever take art history in college? Like that's my background for all this. It's just that I thought I was going to be an art historian for like 2 years. And so I would like get super stoned and watch slideshows, which we had at the time, and then would fall asleep. But like there are like feast paintings are just, it's a genre. And they often are biblical, right? There's the Feast at Canaan, I think. There's a couple of famous ones, like especially sort of early high Renaissance, I would say. And they always have like little visual gags. There's one, I want to say Veronese, but I don't think that's right, where like there's a little dog pissing against the table and whatever, right? Like they're busy canvases. They have a kind of a, they have a little bit of Bruegel energy, right? Like there's like weird shit happening because like it's a big, busy canvas and you can have some fun with it, right? So like even if that had been take on The Last Supper, it would have been very much in keeping with what they were trying to say about the Louvre. And the people freaking out about it were just like guardians of a tradition that they seem to know jack shit about.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that does recur to me a lot in the like new right or online right's treatment of this Western tradition that they claim to revere is that they never understand that people in the past can be joking. It's like how they don't think that women are ever joking. They assume that women are always like dead serious and stupid. And they also don't think that any dead white men can ever be joking. Those dead white men are always dead serious and right, you know, which like leads them down some like very interesting pathways. So the idea that sort of making fun or containing some irreverence or humor might in fact be a part of that tradition strikes me as something that just wouldn't be on their radar.
Yeah. No, I think that's so right. And it's also, I think, very central to their complaint that the classics are no longer being taught in American colleges, right? Like, as someone who does this shit for a living, that's all we fucking do. I mean, like, not all, but like, it's a lot of what we fucking do. Like, of course, Hume, Locke, Kant are still taught at American colleges. What we don't do is hero worship, right? And that's kind of what they want. And frankly, hero worship often is very incompatible with actually spending time with, you know, any, not just dead white male thinkers, but any old thinker, right? I mean, like we did an interview about a month ago with Alex Ross, right? Who has devoted an immense amount of his life to Wagner. And no one can make funnier jokes about Wagner than him. Like the more you immerse yourself in something, taking it seriously also means being able to be unserious about it. And like, you're absolutely right that this kind of trad fixation betrays its insecurity about the object that it pretends to venerate. It really is uncomfortable with it, right? You know, like any fetishism, it isn't very good at looking at what it actually is venerating.
Right.
And I mean, that goes for the Olympics too, right? Like they're like, oh, this is incompatible with the tradition of the Olympics. Like, what, the one with the dongs, right? Like, where everyone was like hanging brain for 800 years? Like, yeah. Like, the Greeks would have been really offended by that.
The Olympics itself is a pastiche of an imagined past.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, when did they start these? Like, the early 20th century, the modern Olympics?
I want to say 1890s. This is something we should look up. And I should have looked this up before. 1896 summer. In Paris.
They
were organized in Paris, but the first one took place in Athens. Makes sense, obviously. But it was a French joint, the whole thing. But yeah, so like, right, like put a pin in that date to our listeners. Like that's not accidental.
1896.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's a moment of high nationalism, right? We're less than 20 years away from everyone just going fucking ape at each other for like the dumbest chain of reasons in the history of the world. But also like, it's a time when, let's say, the fixation on certain kinds of bodies becomes really, really important. This is sort of the high point in France of fears about dégénérescence, so basically like physical degeneration or decadence. It's also the moment when we start, I think, getting more school sports, where we get a lot of fixation on clean drinking water, et cetera, et cetera. And that's great. But it also is like a moment when everyone's like, the working class is diseased,
right?
They're all drinking themselves to death and becoming prostitutes. You know, this is sort of where eugenics really attains a broader currency is around that time.
Well, it is the post-industrial urbanization period, right? In which now, instead of being what was imagined to be like sort of quaint, wholesome, morally innocent agrarian peasants, now the mass of your populace are all crammed together in these cities. And they are understood to be deprived physically, but also crucially morally of this essential character that was embodied by physical agrarian, like agricultural labor, right?
Yeah. And I mean, a cynic might put it this way and might just say this was when the rich finally had to live kind of cheek by jowl with the poor.
Yeah.
Right? They didn't just like ride past them, but they're like, whoa, these people are malnourished. Or like, whoa, these people have to do very demeaning things to get by, right? They were like, well, obviously we can't pay them more. So what if a lecture? What if but a lecture?
Speaking of Marie Antoinette, like famously, this is a person who had a fantasy about what peasant agrarian life was like with the Petit Trianon and her like little like milkmaid bullshit, which is actually very overlapping with a trad wife fantasy as well, right?
Yeah, the OG trad wife.
This like fantastical, imagined, like really like collage version of multiple different pasts all laid on top of each other to evoke an authenticity, a moral uprightness, and by extension, a physical health. This is also where you get like the yoga to anti-vax pipeline also partakes of this fantasy of the natural or like the pre-industrial or the pre-medicalization pure body as being something that you can find in a return to the past. Whereas actual peasants of the pre-industrial era had a lot of diseases and not a lot of teeth and short lives.
Yeah. And I mean, it, to be fair, it is also a moment when just like living in a city is fucking unhealthy. You know, everyone's sort of squished together, you know, everyone's heating with coal by that point, right? So like everyone's got some kind of lung disease. And also, you know, there's not a small element of racial anxieties. It's usually not yet kind of colonial subjects coming to Europe, but it's often people who are sort of off-white, you know, so the white other, right? Like kind of coming
just say Italians. I'm sorry.
Right. Like within, it's like within Italy, it's Southern Italians. Within France, it's usually like people from the South. In Germany, it's often Catholics. So the makeup of the poor has to some extent transformed. They look different often, or they people think they perceive differences from them when it comes to themselves. And so like, yeah, so there is this, they are registering some changes, but they're not looking to analyze them in any way that like, you know, they're looking to analyze them, as you say, in questions of moral failing and hygiene.
The calipers won't come out for another few years.
Oh, no, they're
what you're
there.
Saying.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, physiognomy is one of my little side interests.
Your side quests that was
research.
Given to you by a wizard. Yeah.
It's, I when I was in graduate school, I translated a book on it, and so like after I've always been fascinated with it. And I've written one non-academic piece about physiognomy, but otherwise I've just kind of done it in academic settings. But like, it really kind of hits its stride, I would say, in the 1830s and 40s. People like Carl Gustav Carus. And the funny thing is that like any European with any brains was like, this is bullshit. Please stop doing this, right? Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel has an entire chapter in his 1806 book, The Phenomenology of Spirit, where he's like, okay, here's why this is bullshit, right? Which has the great line, the spirit is not a bone. He's like, you can't get there from here, right? Like someone can have the brain pan of a murderer. If they don't murder someone, guess what? They're not a murderer. So that's not going to work, you guys. And yet it sort of kept coming up. And my theory has always been it's because it was an easy way for the bourgeoisie to manage cognitive dissonance, right? It was a way to say like the people who are abjectly poor while I'm doing pretty well kind of did it to themselves, right? There's something or their ancestors did it or nature did it, whatever it is. I don't have to feel bad about it. It's just like, it is what it is, right? And I think that the Olympics are an expression of that spirit, right? Like when we get to the category of fairness in the Olympics, there is a distinction here about what are natural differences, quote unquote, what are differences that are good and important and worth celebrating, and what are differences that are bad and illegitimate, right? And cheating in a way, right? Like, so this question of naturalness and we can sort of say what's natural and what's not is central both to these bourgeois, not even disciplines, they're not disciplines of knowledge, they're just kind of habits, right? Like people would have these books at home of like famous faces where you can sort of like learn what a good face looks like, right? Like absolute bunk, right? And, you know, the Olympics, which are basically a celebration of well-built bodies.
So do you want to talk about women's boxing?
Yeah, which we all became experts in the last... Were you into it before? Because I absolutely was not.
No, I mean, boxing, if I'm going to be real with you, I think boxing should be banned for everyone. It's violence is the kind that just like freaks me out. For some reason, I really love rugby. I love watching women's rugby, which is profoundly violent. It is a really violent sport in which there are no helmets and no padding.
Yeah.
And like American football, it's like probably like just really horrifically terrible for the people who play it.
Yeah.
For reasons that don't make sense to me and which I probably could not defend, I love watching women's rugby. but women's boxing had not been on my radar. And frankly, I don't think it had been on many people's radar.
Yeah. The same way that the feast-related holdings of the Louvre were not on anyone's bailiwick or very few people's bailiwick before people decided to make a huge fucking issue out of it. I think the same, like everyone became a fucking sports punch expert overnight on August 1st, I believe it was, when Iman Khalif, a boxer from Algeria, fought Angela Carini, I believe, of Italy, and basically won the fight in 40 seconds.
Carini withdrew. She forfeited the match very quickly and afterwards appeared at a press conference in tears. And seemed, you know, she says something to the effect of like, I've never been hit that hard in my life before. It's not fair. She like later tried to walk that back, but her post-forfeit comments were seized upon by the online right, by like J.K. Rowling, by a series of people who want to make a fuss about, you know, their own transphobia and use any excuse to have their transphobia influence policy to suggest that Iman Khalif was transgender, which she's not.
They want to have men playing in women's sports. You saw the boxer today, the Italian female boxer, just saying, I can't be
two shots.
She pulled away. She said, I can't fight this.
40 seconds in.
There will be no men playing in women's sports when we're elected.
I said in my piece, like there were three different versions of this and no one ever like had to sort of explain what they meant, right? There were those who thought, who clearly sort of proposed that Khalif was trans, which she's not. There were those who claimed that, I forget what that's called, but like it's something that like Quillette loves, like differential sexual development or whatever, right? Like, so basically, yeah, this is someone who develops sort of male characteristic, quote unquote, whatever the fuck that means, like later in life, even though she was born and raised a girl.
Is it technically a kind of intersex? Is it under the intersex umbrella?
Well, that was the other thing. People sort of suggested she might be intersex. I think that I'm not sure, but like basically those were the three things that I sort of saw implied.
Okay, so either this was a person assigned male at birth who transitioned to living and competing as a woman, or this person was born with an ambiguously sexed body and is living and competing as a woman. Or this person is some sort of like, it seems like differential sex development almost like splits the difference. It's like an in-betweener. Yeah. Iman Khalif is, you know, assigned female living as a woman, but her body is somehow not womanly enough.
Enough, exactly. Yeah. Right. She shades into the wrong territory. And so two things to say about that, right? One is Iman Khalif herself pointed out, I believe, in an interview that like a lot of the media sort of picks up on this like only after the fight. But the people that she fought against, of course, like boxing is not apparently not that big a world. Like they knew her. Like she had trained in Italy, apparently. So like these people know that that is not the case.
The people competing with her know that that's not the case. Yeah.
Yeah. And frankly, like she's having a very good Olympics. She hasn't always had very good, like she's been beaten by some of these people before, right? So like it's very strange. Like, you know, it gets very much picked out exactly like the Last Supper thing. But the second thing I want to point out is that like this entire torrent of like, just asking questions coverage that you then get, right? You get the outright transphobe, you get your J.K. Rowlings, you get your, you know, oh, this is a man who gets off on punching women. You're like, oh my God, like, just shut up. But then you get these, like, just asking questions like, well, there are serious issues here about, you know, women's sports and how to protect them, blah, blah, blah. And we should say, all of this is based, this is both about her and about Lin Yuting, who is another boxer who this was—
from Taiwan,
from
I believe.
Taiwan, that's right.
This is all hung on allegedly like tests that were conducted on these two women's boxers by an unrelated sports accrediting agency that determined they were male somehow. Tell me, like, because this is what these transphobes who are smearing Iman Khalif are really hanging their whole argument on these old test results. And I don't actually know quite what they're talking about. Could you walk us through that?
So that's really interesting. So I looked into this. Like, so people are always saying like, oh, the Olympics have to have rules. Like, that's bullshit. The Olympics apparently have rules. The rules are the individual competitions are organized by bodies for that particular sport. And they decide apparently what the rules are, right? They basically administer this because the IOC, I think is both too corrupt and not interested in this, right?
Yeah, like the IOC is like a glorified real estate development bribery racket.
It's a bunch of Swiss people trying to get rich. Yeah, exactly. But so like they leave it to, right, like if you're an equestrian, it'll be like, I don't know, the Equestrian Association or whatever, right? The problem with boxing is that it doesn't have one right now. There is an international boxing association, the IBA, but it is shady as fuck. And most specifically, it's shady as fuck and like basically an extension of the Putin regime. And so basically the IOC was like, you can't run this. We're going to run it ourselves.
So even the IOC, these are people who are too corrupt for the IOC.
Yeah. They're like, whoa. Okay. Like, this is not just a real estate thing. Yeah. But the test in 2023 that Lin Yuting and Iman Khalif allegedly failed.
It's some sort of like biological sex test.
Yeah.
Right?
But they never say what it is.
So we don't know what they were actually tested for.
Yeah, they don't know what the test is.
On the 23rd of March, the results came through and it demonstrated the chromosomes that we refer to within the technical and competition rules that make both boxers ineligible. And that was then further ratified by the BOD, our board of directors. It was taken there to remove both boxers from the championships. We're not able to disclose the results of any tests.
Now, I haven't looked into this. I don't know whether or not like that kind of testing is standard, meaning what's supposed to have happened? Like Iman Khalif hit her head real hard and acquired some Y chromosomes that way? Like what? Like surely this would have come up before, right? Like, but no. So we have this like alleged test.
And presumably Iman Khalif and Lin Yuting, presumably they have also been tested for other competitions by other bodies, right?
That's what I would imagine. I don't know. But so the thing is the IBA, for us normies, the story, and really also for the people freaking out, the story starts on August 1st, but it turns out that's not the case. Time magazine has a very nice rundown of that, that basically the IBA, even though it wasn't allowed to be part of the Paris Olympics, has been kind of pushing the story out via Twitter during and even before the games, right? So they told Russian news agencies that Ting and Khalif had XY chromosomes and were excluded from the event, therefore, blah, blah, blah. But they also very clearly were interested in juking up a little bit of controversy about the Paris Olympics, which they weren't allowed to be part of. And you know, Russian athletes were not allowed to be part of. So for instance, the head of the IBA, his name is Kremlev, wrote on July 26th of 2024 that the 2024 Olympic Games are outright sodomy and the destruction of traditional values throughout the world. And Thomas Bach, who is the IOC chairman, is responsible for this, right? So like,
I don't know, that sounds kind of like a good time.
I know. I mean, I would have gone if I'd known that. Now you're telling me, Kremlev. But the point is, like, they were pushing this story out ahead of time.
Okay, so this was engineered.
I can't swear to it. There's also a suggestion. I didn't quite understand this. Like, it's possible that the test in New Delhi happened after a fight that one of the two had won, meaning it was used to disqualify someone. Like, who knows? It might have just been that someone bet a bunch of money and was like trying to get their bet back. But like, whatever it is, like it's clearly an interested party. They're clearly pushing, they're trying to get a culture war started. And they, for some reason, refused to just answer the very simple question for out of privacy concerns, right? They like got these women tons of death threats, but they have allegedly privacy concerns and therefore won't tell us what fucking tests they ran.
Yeah, and like this person's genitals and DNA is not supposed to be private, but your testing regime is very private.
Unbelievable, right? But all I want to say is that like all this fucking discourse based on just the flimsiest of nudges that maybe there's something there, right?
Let's also be clear that like this is all about upholding a division of bodies into two binary categories.
Exactly.
It's not wholly arbitrary, but its relevance to each one of these specific sports might be, you know, questionable or contingent or imaginary. And like the division of upholding the sex division of these sports, that commitment is not really being questioned throughout this.
Yeah, including by the IOC. That's right.
Yeah, by nobody. Like even the defenses of Khalif are she's not trans.
Yeah.
Which raises the question to me at least is like, well, would it really be a problem if she was, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm also interested in how Khalif and the Algerians have responded to this, because it's what's really fascinating to me is that Algeria, which is not exactly a like queer and trans friendly country, it is illegal to change your sex on any kind of documentation there. I believe homosexuality is illegal in Algeria.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Yeah, that's the other thing. People are accusing this woman of a crime that would, I think, come with serious jail time. I mean, it's so incredibly gross if you think about it.
But Algeria is, in fact, taking this on as kind of a nationalist cause.
Yeah.
They're saying, you know, they are trying to deny or undermine the excellence of Algeria. I think it does not hurt that these Olympics are in Paris. And yeah, a lot of the authority figures are like, you know, speaking in French to rile up Algerian nationalist yeah spirit. But like this person who...
They're watching Battle of Algiers, like on yeah YouTube. Jazz themselves up for their press conferences.
Yeah, you know, but like Iman Khalif, who, you know, I don't actually know a lot about this woman's life or identity, but she looks to me like a pretty standard, like millennial Gen Z butch lesbian, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Who is not who I think of as an icon of national pride for Algeria. And yeah, yet she has become so because of the way that her talent and hard work have been undermined and insulted by these Western officials, right? So you see this like upsurge of like a post-colonialist nationalist pride around a figure that like in some of these post-colonial like activist circles would be understood as like a decadent Western import, right? It's a very interesting clash,
yeah,
or like maybe non-intuitive unification,
yeah,
of like sex and racial politics.
So there's a precedent for this when Caster Semenya was challenged on her sex.
Where's Caster Semenya from?
South Africa.
South Africa. South Africa, which has really horrendous anti-lesbian homophobia.
Yes, but also, but good laws, oddly enough, right? Good constitution on that stuff. But still, people really came out to support and defend her. And there's a great article by Zine Magubane, I hope I'm saying that right, about this case, pointing out that like part of it is that like the very category of intersex has sort of a colonial legacy. It was often used to kind of to class bodies that sort of didn't fit in with white European femininity. And so the argument of that piece is that that just had to raise heckles because people sort of understand what the disciplining function of these categories and of this way of reading bodies at all is, right? And I think there's definitely something to that, especially at the Olympics, right? Part of what happened here clearly is that, you know, the Olympics are a massive image factory. There's like so many images produced by this. And one thing that happened with the Khalif fight is that these transphobes would just share stills from the fight, right? In which, let's say, Khalif did indeed look not stereotypically feminine, right? Like, oh, you're telling me this is a woman, right? Like, I can take a snapshot of you with like your mouth in any shape, right? Like if you, yeah, like with yeah, a fast yeah enough shutter speed, you can do that. But like we're used to these athletes' bodies being sort of scrutinized in this way, in slow motion, in stills, right? The photo finish, et cetera, et cetera. And so like people didn't notice that like they were being fed extremely selective visual evidence and they were being asked to kind of become armchair diagnosticians. But of course, we're always asked to be armchair diagnosticians at the Olympics. One example I give in my Substack post is the way a lot of sports commentators still kind of joke about like Chinese athletes' age, right? Like, oh, yeah, this gymnast is like probably 12 or whatever. And it's like, yeah, or she's short. Like, I mean, I don't know, man. Like, maybe let's not contemplate this person's body beyond like what it's currently doing, right? Like, I don't think we need to like comment on her boobs. Like that's just like, that feels weird.
It compounds with various gendered racisms, right?
Yeah,
so like
yeah,
Imani Khalif and Caster Semenya, they are Arab and Black respectively, right?
Yeah.
And those are populations that are subjected to a masculinizing racism.
Yeah.
They are understood to be more manly and women from those populations are understood to be like less real as women. Whereas what's interesting to me also is that a Taiwanese boxer is implicated. And that is a feminizing racism, again, that typically gets deployed against East Asians, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that is also an unusual confluence of racism
right
and misogyny
yeah, yeah
and transphobia all wrapped up in the controversy over this boxer. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
I don't know that much about her. I mean, I think she was lucky in that I think her fights were not as widely, like there wasn't a spectacular incident like with Angela Carini. Though she also, like Khalif, I think gave a very good press conference where she, you know, called all this out and sort of said like, "What the hell are you doing in my life?" But yeah, it's interesting, right? Like it's very noticeable that we are, like I'm not an Olympics historian, but it does feel like the big cases tend to involve non-white people, right, or non-Europeans.
And candidly, it's only ever women's sports.
Yeah,
nobody is ever going to, you know, an Olympic gymnast, or even in sports where, you know, women are not necessarily perceived to be incapable of competing at an elite level, like say gymnastics.
Yeah.
Nobody's looking at a gymnast and saying he's too impossibly tiny. he cannot really be a man. He must be secretly a woman, like trying to cheat. Like that's not happening. It's womanhood that's being policed and disciplined.
Yes, except that, of course, that the whole, you know, this person got doped, right? Like it's also like a way that can work for both genders, I feel like. It's really all about gender construction, right? It's like which ones are the salient biological features that make up someone's quote-unquote sex? And what are the things that are just the way he is, right? Like Michael Phelps is a freak of nature, absolute freak of nature.
He all but has gills. It's nuts.
Yeah,
he's got, what has he got? Like webbed feet and the really long wingspan and the...
Like double jointed, which, you know, some people are, some people aren't. There's some kind of acid that doesn't build up as quickly, meaning his muscles don't tire. Like,
didn't you have an example in your newsletter of one athlete who just like literally didn't feel pain? Was that it?
Oh no, that was someone else, but they saw that. Yeah, yeah. So, like it's exactly right. I mean, like that's close to a fucking X-Man at that point, right? Like, you know, you should start for Dr. Xavier's school for gifted youngsters. But like, that's somehow okay. You know, the power that is imputed to Iman Khalif's non-existent Y chromosome is like really kind of amazing, right? Like when we countenance all these other things. I mean, I'm going to say something controversial here, but like there was a picture going around of Simone Biles standing next to Shaq, and like she also like is impossibly tiny. Like that is like, that I didn't know people came that small. I'm sorry.
I mean, next to Shaq, we all look quite tiny. All right. Like as a woman of 5'2" experience.
But she might be like 4'8" or something like that, right? She's like very short.
She's quite small. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure that helps, right? But like, that's not salient and we don't talk about that. Like I didn't realize how small she was. I just thought she was a powerful athlete. And of course, no one would break down crying and refuse to shake Simone Biles' hand or Michael Phelps' hand and say, that was not fair, right? That's the thing.
Right.
It's not just about what's scientific. People can couch it in all the craniometry and all the weird like face measuring they want. Be like, is that what a man's face looks like, right? Like,
oh,
is that what a woman's face looks like? They can do that all they want. This is ultimately about the moralization of nature, right? Like, it's never a question about like, what is the effect? It's the question of, is it fair? Right. And my point is that like in the Olympics, we accept unfairness sort of at the word go.
Well, this is just the nature of athletic competition, right?
Yeah.
Is that it is a mix of the things that we kind of talk about in, you know, misty-eyed sentimental terms, like dedication, passion,
that's definitely
perseverance,
part of it,
like legitimately moralizable qualities. Like a lot of these athletes are people who, I mean, Simone Biles is a great example, legitimately had to overcome tremendous hardship. Like legitimately had to spend tons and tons and tons of time when she probably would have rather been doing other things.
Yeah.
Practicing over and over and over again, right? Like there's part of the Simone Biles story that is profoundly moralizable.
Yeah.
Right? And I think quite legitimately so. And then there's the part of the Simone Biles story and every athlete's story that is completely unmoralizable, right? That is completely devoid of input by human agency, that is devoid of like moral cause. You know, she's short. She didn't do anything to make herself short.
Right.
That was a genetic roll of the dice that happened to be in her favor. And it's to nobody's credit and it is nobody's fault, right? Like she just is.
Yeah.
Michael Phelps has all of his weird things, completely amoral roll of the dice. It's something he just seems to have. And that's sort of similar on what get classified as these like male and female traits, right?
Exactly.
But suddenly a moralization of those qualities clicks into place when they become gendered.
Yeah.
And that is very interesting to me.
Yeah, right. It's unfair that there is even the trace of masculinity in this. And like,
I'm sorry, it's also boxing. It's like, you're, like, find me the dainty, feminine trad wife who wants to beat up other women for exercise. Like, I just don't, I don't think she's out there. I think these are good. It's going to selectively draw, like a lot of women's sports selectively draw from women who have more masculine interests and will develop as a result of those interests, more masculine physiques.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, two points about that. One is, I mean, there was an attempt, right, to cast Angela Carini as this damsel in distress. In fact, the next fighter, I forget her name now, Hungarian fighter that Khalif beat, put on her Instagram a meme of herself and Khalif as Beauty and the Beast, right? So like there is this like
Khalif was like this giant like minotaur like figure. Like,
it was basically from the movie. It was basically
Tiny little white woman with blonde hair, very skinny, in a boxing ring facing down this gigantic, like literal monster.
Right.
And then actually I saw the picture after Khalif won that fight, and the Hungarian boxer who posted that meme was actually substantially physically larger than her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, right? Like, there's that. And then the other thing, of course, is that they attach it to these weird sort of physiognomic categories, like her facial structure. But then they even attach it to, like, would a woman dress this way, right? There's a video that went around where, like, she's sort of scratching under her shorts. It's like, a woman would never do this. Like, first of, meet one. Just try and meet one. Second of, like, she looks good in a suit. Again, like, I don't want to, if she's straight, I'd be a little surprised. My DAR is definitely going off.
I was looking at these pictures that the transphobes were posting of Iman Khalif trying to prove that this person was secretly a man or, like, secretly assigned male at birth or whatever they're alleging. And I was like, in Algiers, there are, like, four women who are waiting for a text back from this person, right? You know, like I know so many women with exactly this gender presentation, and it's frankly, it's not that far outside the norm. I just don't think I've tweeted, these people are acting like they've never seen a butch before.
Yeah, that was a great tweet. Yeah.
And frankly, like, butches are not that uncommon.
Yeah.
Thank God. Yeah. But like, this is from the same group of people, this transphobic online movement, who have this weird theme that butch lesbians are going extinct because they are, you know, being seduced into transgenderism.
Yeah.
And then when they're actually encountering one in the real world, they are insisting that she is not a man. And in fact, the person looking at a masculine woman and saying that's in fact a man, that's the transphobes. That's the transphobes who are trying to enforce that boundary and narrow the category of womanhood so that it can only accommodate a very small number of people, and the rest of us get pushed out.
You know, and I mean, like, I think you pointed this out on Twitter as well, but like, these people who've been going on and on about women's spaces are
nobody
using
will tell me what that means, by the way.
Yeah,
are you
right,
talking
whatever.
About like...
like shitters?
The bathroom at a TGI Fridays? Like, what are you talking about? Yeah,
would you want to take shit at a TGI Fridays next to a man, Moira?
There's no place I ever...
there's most
no place
sacred
I ever
space
feel
that we have in the West.
Safe. Yeah, it's a bathroom at a Chili's. Yeah.
Where someone just like evacuates their bowels after a margarita. You're like, oh, this is my temple. This is what I get. The 10 minutes of peace of shitting my guts out at the TGI Fridays.
But like they talk really breathless terms about these spaces as if we do not live in a gender integrated world.
Yeah.
You know?
But then even that, like...
I'm sorry, it's separate spheres. That's all it is.
But if they're then going around being like, oh, this is not a woman, she doesn't belong here. It's like, yeah, so you're just kicking lesbians or women who present too masculine out of like women's spaces. Like, who now is destroying those spaces, right? Like, it's
who
very,
now
very
is
strange.
Hostile to lesbians, the people you keep trying, who never asked for this, you know?
Yeah.
These like weird British boomer straight women who are obsessed nominally about me and my welfare and then also give me shit when they see me in the bathroom, you know? It's
know,
like, please
right?
leave me alone. Like, I don't want to be living in your head rent free like this.
Again, I just had a margarita and I need to, it needs out. We can talk about how to define woman in a second, but right now I'm having a case of ass spraying mayhem. In this our sanctum, it's nuts, right? I mean, like, that's in some way, I mean, like, I feel horrible for the athletes in all this, but it was almost darkly funny to observe these people's categories come completely unglued in the space of like 24 hours, right? Like, as you say, like the ones who are like, we must protect lesbians.
Were and then they see one homophobic. And they're like, everybody needs to be protected from this evil lesbian, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the category of woman just gets smaller and smaller and smaller in their imagination in order to exclude anything that makes them uncomfortable. And I'm sorry, it's just too many people. Like, it's just too many people for all of them to be somebody that you like.
Yeah, right. I mean, and I mean, like, this is not a new point, but like, people have pointed out that like, that's probably the reason why TERFism is so dominant in the UK. It is ultimately an imperial feminism, right? It's a feminism that wants to teach other women how to be women, and a lot of the categories that they're applying to Iman Khalif seem to me to come out of that project, out of the project of imperialism, right? Where it's like, oh no, you guys are doing gender wrong, and so therefore we must teach you.
Sometimes in my life, I get assigned to be like a TERF whisperer. Somebody will be like, look, can you talk to my mom and get her off of it? Like, this happens to me every now and then. Yeah, and it's something that like I have enough privilege and frankly enough patience that I can do. Like, I can go and sit down with somebody and I can convince them to take my own commitment to, like, you know, alleviating cis women's oppression seriously enough that they can trust me and I can try and reason with them out of this. And I will say it's actually not as hard as I used to fear it would be. Mm. Like, people are reasonable with if they trust your commitment to feminism. But this specific kind of spectacle or imagined spectacle of a very violent sport with a large audience in which cis woman winds up crying, that is exactly the kind of thing that would undo all of those conversations.
Yeah,
right?
That's a good point.
Because it is a punch.
Yeah.
And these are people who are alert, I think not unfairly, to the widespread nature and, you know, pretty much universal acceptance of men's violence against women, right?
Yeah.
And part of it is this like weird insult of the media substitution in which this instance, which is not men's violence against women, right? It is two women competing in a sport, gets assigned all of the moral outrage that isn't being applied to actual male violence against women, right?
Actual wife beaters,
Yeah, and like actual domestic abuse, which is a fucking epidemic and kills a tremendous amount of women, right? It's almost like this photo negative, right? Because all of the attention that is not being paid to violence by actual men that enforces this gender hierarchy, all of that moral attention that is absent becomes present in policing the same gender hierarchy in the name of protecting women. That is very interesting to me, right? It's almost like how like people who don't give a shit about rape get very, very up in arms about the prospect of false rape allegations, which like aren't really happening, right?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, this is how you are dealing with the shame of accepting and functionally tolerating domestic violence in your actual life and communities, is that you're sort of inverting that shame and externalizing it onto random people.
Yeah.
Who you can make, you know, projection screens for the things you don't like about yourself.
Yeah.
I sound a little bit like, you know, a crank here, but I think there's something up with like the absence of actual concern about violence against women.
Well, no, it's true. And I mean, the other thing, of course, that's very noticeable is that like for this brigade, femininity only ever exists as a category under attack, right? And the idea of like, oh, there's two women punching each other. That's interesting, right? Like, it's not something I like to watch, but like it's something that someone might like to watch. You know, it's all about women equals objects of violence, right? Like, that's the only thing they could see. There's a woman being beaten, right? And it's like, well, but there's a woman doing it. So I'm not sure this is whatever the gender politics are, they're at a higher level, right? Like the people who organize these things, the people who train these women, like, yeah, I wonder about that. But at the same time, they're just trying to make it into something that kind of evacuates womanhood of anything that isn't always about defense, limiting, and kind of delimitation, right? Like they're basically like, woman is a safe space, right? Like, and anything that happens to it is a violation of a safe space, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, this is a fantasy of like women's spaces as these sanctuaries from a violent world.
Right.
It takes very seriously, I think, appropriately the prospect of violence against women by men, but it then ignores the prospect of violence against women by women, right? It imagines all women as allies, which is, again, just something that the category is too big to allow for. That is, it is frankly too many people for all of them to like each other.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to land a punch.
You know, I'm not going to do it, but some women will fight you.
Yeah. Oh, and we should mention that the IBA, meanwhile, has flown to Paris to put on a bunch of doctors and do a big press conference about these two athletes. None of the doctors, I read a account of it, and it seems that none of the doctors actually did the test, nor could they say what the test was.
They're all like podiatrists, one's a vet. Exactly. Yeah.
And then this guy Kremlev apparently was like there on Zoom, and he's like, well, you know, they had very high testosterone, and they were like, well, did you test their testosterone? I was like, no, we didn't. Right. So like the whole thing feels very, very fishy. But like it in some way, it's very funny to watch these people who are like, there are two genders, it's all biology, et cetera, be like, well, but maybe there's really a spectrum, and like, right, like you can determine sex in different ways, and sometimes these things don't align. And like, I know, we know, you've been saying this, and you've been calling us postmodern homos or whatever it is you've been calling us, right? Like, isn't this supposed to be the queer theory or gender theory you're also afraid of? Like, now suddenly you're like, oh, what if she's a woman with high testosterone? It's like, yeah, welcome to gender trouble. Like, that's the point. Like, you're trying to make a distinction that nature doesn't make that clearly, right? Because, like, we're stapling together a whole bunch of stuff and calling it sex. And then we stake an entire sporting event on that distinction. And, like, yeah, it's weird how that house of cards you build and then you put it on top of another house of cards is now at risk a full-on collapse. Like, that's really sad and unpredictable. Whoever could have seen this coming?
I will say Iman Khalif has dealt with this with, like, tremendous amount of grace.
Yes.
I saw one interview with her where she was just like, I'm not on social media. And I was like, good for you.
Yeah, that is very smart. She's like, I'm just on Bumble.
It was like 400 unread messages. And she's going to the final. By the time this comes out, she may have already competed.
As is Ting, Lin Yuting.
Are they going to fight each other?
No, they're different weight classes.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, we wish them both well.
Wish them both well. I think they deserve a lot of relaxation and like French bread and cheese and enjoying Paris and not logging onto social media.
Yeah. I will say that it would be now even funnier if they lost both their bouts and watch transphobes lose their minds. I mean, I'm rooting for them to win.
I'm rooting for them to win. They went through so much bullshit.
I'm sure their opponents are also lovely people, and like that would be fine too. And I think it would be the funnier outcome in the sense that then they'd have to explain how these inherent like...
Didn't that happen to Leah Thomas, a swimmer in the NCAA? Like she won some like qualifying race and all the transphobes got up in arms and then she lost the actual final and it wasn't that close. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Leah Thomas is trans and so has to take estrogen supplements. I'm guessing that this is what some people want to have happen here would be my guess.
That was the deal that Caster Semenya was offered. Like you can artificially lower your testosterone. These people who actually have these like physical conditions that are identifiable, which is not true of our boxers.
Yeah. Well, we don't know because the Russians won't say what the fuck they even measured.
And it's exhausting. And it's not in the spirit of sport.
No.
Which we can applaud for from our couches while we eat chocolate chip cookies, which is what I'm going to do for the rest of the Olympics.
That's my gender. My gender is chocolate chip cookie.
Thank you for listening to In Bed With The Right. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
In Bed With The Right would like to thank the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research for generous support, Jennifer Portillo for setting up our studio. Our producer is Katie Lyle.